Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early. Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Imagine a Saturday evening in late September 1937. The sky over Illinois had gone the color of tarnished nickel, and the cornfields along North Avenue stretched black against the last smear of light. Charles Sherman Ross, 72, silver-haired, a little stooped from a heart that had been giving him warnings, guided his big sedan toward Chicago. Beside him sat Florence Fryhage, his friend of 40 years, the woman who used to type his letters when the greeting card company was still just a dream on a kitchen table. They were talking quietly about dinner, about the new fall line of cards, when Florence glanced in the side mirror. "Charles, that car behind us. It's been there for miles. The lights are blinding." Ross frowned, eased the wheel, and pulled onto the gravel shoulder just west of Franklin Park. "I'll let him pass." The trailing car, a dusty Ford coupe, cut hard across the lane and blocked them. A young man jumped out, curly hair, sharp chin, eyes flicking like a cornered fox. He tapped the muzzle of a revolver against Ross's window. "Open the door, or I shoot." The lock clicked. Ross was yanked across the seat, searched, shoved into the back of the Ford. Florence's voice cracked.
"He has a weak heart."
The gunman leaned in. "You his daughter?" "No," Ross answered for her, calm as Sunday. "She's my friend." The barrel pressed into Florence's shoulder. "How much can he pay?" She fumbled $85 from her purse. The kidnapper pocketed it, ordered her to the floorboards. "Call the police and he dies." Tires spat gravel, taillights shrank to red pinpricks and vanished. Florence waited until the sound was gone, then stumbled to the nearest phone. The call she made launched one of the widest manhunts the young FBI had ever known. Before we slip into tonight's tale, I want to take a moment to thank you, our listeners, for being here with us in the dark. If you're loving true crime sleep stories, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. It helps us reach more listeners and keep these haunting tales coming your way. And if you'd like to go a step further, you can become a Patreon member at patreon.com/Kelly Brink. You'll get ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content to feed your true crime curiosity. I'd like to thank our most recent Patreon members for their support. Anne, Patrick, Aaron, Rebecca, Brett, and my friend and fellow podcaster Jason Blair, who has a podcast called The Silver Linings Handbook that'll just make you feel good. So go give him a listen as well. Now, we're going to hear briefly from our sponsors before we dive into your uninterrupted story for tonight. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to True Crime Sleep Stories. Now, settle in and get comfy, because I'm going to tell you a story. Picture yourself riding shotgun in that Ford coupe, pine trees whipping past, the smell of wet earth and gun oil thick in the air. The kidnappers drove all night, north through Wisconsin, into Minnesota, until the roads turned to dirt and the headlights picked out a patch of forest near the little town of Emily. There, under a blanket of pine needles and brush, lay a hole in the ground. 6 feet deep, walls shored with scrap lumber, a wooden trap door for a lid. They shoved Ross inside. The door thudded shut. Darkness swallowed him. The curly-haired man called himself Albie. His partner, a quiet 20-year-old named James Atwood Gray, stayed with the prisoner while Albie headed south to mail the first ransom note. Ross wrote it himself, steady hand, careful cursive, but he insisted on $5,000. Albie changed the $5 to $50, licked the envelope, and dropped it in a mailbox in Savannah, Illinois. Over the next 10 days, 4 more letters arrived at the Ross home, each more elaborate than the last. They demanded the money in fives, tens, and twenties, no consecutive numbers, no marks. They laid out a 395-mile motorcycle route that twisted from Oak Park to Joliet and back under cover of night. They warned about vitamin G, FBI agents, and promised Ross would be freed within 48 hours of payment. Every letter carried a scrap of proof, a snippet of envelope addressed in Ross's own hand, a membership card, a car registration, and every letter bore a Chicago postmark. The family followed every instruction. On Friday, October 8th, a rider in white coveralls left Oak Park at 6 sharp, in a small locked bag, $50,000. 6 miles east of Rockford, headlights flashed behind him. The signal. He hurled the bag into the weeds, gunned the bike another 300 yards, and ditched it exactly as ordered. Albie scooped the money and raced back to Minnesota. By dawn the next day, he was dividing the cash in the flickering light of a kerosene lantern. $30,000 for himself, $20,000 for Gray. Ross, still alive, sat bound in the corner of the dugout, watching. But partnerships built on greed didn't last long in the woods. October 9th, the three of them piled into the Ford and headed southeast, deeper into the pines, to a second hideout, 17 miles northwest of Spooner, Wisconsin. Another hole, colder, deeper. Albie later claimed Gray made a move for the bigger share. A scuffle. All three tumbled into the pit. The gun roared. Gray slumped. Ross, stunned by the fall, didn't get up. Albie emptied the revolver into both bodies, dragged brush over the trap door, and buried the evidence under a foot of dirt and needles. That afternoon, a few miles north of Walker, Minnesota, he buried a portable typewriter case stuffed with nearly $33,000 of the ransom. Then he ran. He ran in a stolen Oldsmobile with a wire-haired terrier riding shotgun. Spokane, Chicago, New York, Miami, New Orleans, Denver, Pecos, Los Angeles. He gambled at racetracks, traded crisp 20s for pari-mutuel tickets. Always moving, always spending. Meanwhile, the FBI flooded the country with serial number lists. Every bank teller, every racetrack cashier, every citizen with a suspicious bill mailed it in. The trail lit up like Christmas on J. Edgar Hoover's wall map. Early January 1938. Ransom 20s started turning up at Santa Anita Racetrack outside Los Angeles. Hoover flew west himself. Agents slipped behind the betting windows disguised as cashiers. 500 windows, $1 million a day. They waited. January 14th, third race. A slim man in a gray coat stepped to window 23, slid a 20 across the counter. The agent's thumb flipped the bill. Serial number matched. A nod. Plainclothes closed in. No fuss, no scene. they hustled him out a side door and into a waiting car. John Henry Seedlund, alias Peter Ander, didn't fight. In his pockets, his hotel room, and his Oldsmobile was almost $15,000, including $6,000 in Ross ransom money. Hoover questioned him for hours. Seedlund denied, deflected, then cracked. 28 pages of confession spilled out in a hotel room overlooking the Pacific. The dugouts, the fight, the bodies, the buried cash. Every detail matched the letters, the photographs, the motorcycle route. January 19th, snowshoes, sleds, shackles. Seedlund led the agents first to the typewriter case. $32,645 still crisp inside, then to the empty Emily dugout. Finally, horses pulled them through drifts to Spooner. He pointed to a mound of brush. Agents lifted the trap door. James Atwood Gray lay face down, naked, bullet holes black against pale skin. Beside him, Charles Ross, still wearing the dark suit from North Avenue. Seedlund lunged, swinging his handcuffs like a club. Agents wrestled him into the snow. He apologized, almost politely, and the caravan turned back toward civilization. Chicago, July 14, 1938, Cook County Jail. John Henry Seedlund, 27 years old, walked the last 13 steps to the electric chair. Straps tightened. The switch dropped. 3 days later, he was buried in Klondike Cemetery, 2 miles south of Ironton, Minnesota, beside the father he had lost to carbon monoxide 5 years earlier. Charles Ross never came home. $50,000 bought 15 days of hope and a shallow grave in the North Woods. The FBI recovered all but about $2,000 of the ransom. Every bill accounted for except the handful Seedlund gambled away before the trap snapped shut. Florence Freihug lived until 1965, carrying the sound of that revolver tap for 28 years. The greeting card empire passed to new hands. The dugouts rotted back into the earth. What lingered was the reminder. Greed was a brittle partnership, and even the perfect crime left footprints in the snow. True Crime Sleep Stories is hosted and created by Kelly Brink, produced with the support of our dedicated team. Subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform to help us keep telling these haunting tales. Visit patreon.com/kellybrink for exclusive content and to join our community. Thank you for listening, and we'll meet you in the shadows next time. Until then, stay safe out there and lock your doors. Good night.